Hello and welcome to the CISS podcast. This is the On the Spot series by China Forum. In this series, we return to the platform of international forums and webinars where leading minds in academia, government, business, technology, and media deliver novel, collaborative responses to the global issues of the day.
Hello and welcome to CISS podcast, On the Spot series. This is Beibei with China Forum. 45 years into the China-U.S. diplomatic relationship, the two countries have been navigating through some rough waters in recent years. Are the two countries on an inevitable collision course? Can the two countries be in a competition racing to the top, or does it have to be a race to the bottom? Joining me today is Ms. Susan Thornton, a retired senior U.S. diplomat with almost three decades of experience with the U.S. State Department in Eurasia and East Asia. Ms. Thornton is currently a senior fellow at the Yale Law School Paul Tsai China Center. I caught up with Ms. Susan Thornton on the sidelines of the 6th International Forum on Security and Strategy organized by CISS Tsinghua University in late March. For enlightening answers to all these questions and more, here is Ms. Thornton.
Hello, Ms. Thornton. We're very happy to have you on our interview. So the first day this year of 2024 marked the 45th anniversary of the establishment of the diplomatic relationship between China and the U.S. And we can see for the most part, things have worked out pretty well. It's built on principles of mutual respect, peaceful coexistence, and to a great extent, we've achieved win-win cooperation. But we can see that things are kind of taking a different turn in recent years. And in the commemoration event for the anniversary, one question stood out. That is, are China and the United States partners or adversaries? And which was described as an overarching question determining the direction of the relationship.
Yeah, well, great to be with you. Thanks for having me. It's been an interesting couple of days, and it's really good to have a chance to get into some deep conversations
Wonderful.
With our Chinese counterparts. You know, of course, now a lot of people are concerned about the trajectory of U.S.-China relations. And as you know, we've had 45 years of, I think, pretty constructive and productive interactions. You know, we've always had these ups and downs in the relationship. Two big countries, very different countries. Of course, we have frictions, crises, tensions. But in the last few years, I think we've seen a kind of a big departure in the traditional kind of way in which we've interacted, in the way in which we've viewed each other as a kind of a symbiotic partnership. And I don't think it's useful for either the U.S. or China to think in terms of adversaries or enemies, because this kind of gets us into a binary dynamic that has a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy to it. And so, you know, it's very complicated, our relationship. It can't really be easily defined by some certain term, I don't think. I mean, if you listen to authoritative U.S. government officials, I think the way that they have come to describe it as a competition. And I don't necessarily think that's a great description of a relationship, but maybe it captures both the kind of rivalry between the U.S. and China, these two big countries. It can be a win-win competition, right? It can be a healthy competition. And so there's that possibility. You know, probably, unfortunately, right now, it's more of a lose-lose competition. And we have to get out of that cycle and bring it back toward a win-win healthy competition where we're trying to both get to the top and not a race to the bottom.
Exactly. If we could just pull back from that, you are either on the table or on the menu mentality. What kind of opportunity do you see, you know, in ways that China and the U.S. can be partners and maybe even work together to contribute to solving global challenges?
Well, I do think that the main threats in both our countries face in the coming sort of 5, 10, 20 years are going to be those threats that come from transnational challenges, global issues, things that cross borders. I mean, we've seen that with COVID-19, certainly. the U.S. and China used to have very good cooperation on pandemic and pandemic detection and pandemic surveillance. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we didn't do that in this last pandemic, and we suffered the consequences of failing to cooperate. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very important that we learn that lesson. I mean, we also have, of course, in front of us a couple of other very big challenges that we know are coming, right? Mm-hmm. We have climate change. We have the emerging new technologies, which everyone is talking about. We were talking earlier about AI. I mean, almost every person involved in the development of AI says it's very dangerous. Mm-hmm. So we probably should believe them. So I think we need to face up to these very real challenges, not try to manufacture more problems for ourselves.
We have enough real problems on the ground. That's a really good point. And speaking of reality, in your interview with UC San Diego, you said, "I believe a realistic assessment of American interests should dictate a change to the current approach to China by the U.S. government. And based on a cool-headed assessment of the realities on the ground and the workability of our current strategy, you say, I reluctantly conclude that American interests are going to be ill-served if we continue down this path." So what is this more realistic assessment of American interests when it comes to its approach to China?
Yeah, I think what I see happening is, for the sake of a competition, there's a kind of a, you know, as I said, I hope it will be a competition for the better.
Right.
But in the case where you have a kind of competition that is damaging to both countries, a sort of lose-lose competition, you're seeing that it's not serving the interests of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that sort of harm that's being done by sort of diverting trade and other things, you're seeing the devotion of resources that could be used toward some of the domestic kinds of reforms and changes that obviously need to be made. We're facing a lot of domestic challenges, and I think many countries are doing that.
Right.
So you see the diversion of resources into this kind of security and military competition that, in my view, should be devoted to more positive and productive efforts. You know, the green transition for our economy is extremely important, but it's going to be very expensive.
Mm.
And we should be able to use those resources to put into those kinds of efforts as opposed to sort of building up for a military competition.
But I think when we hear the word competition, we kind of naturally frame it as a negative thing. But I think it's a really good point that you mentioned. It could be healthy competition.
Right.
Some mindset change from both parties to drive it that way.
Yeah, when you think about, for example, the competition among businesses in some sector, it's a competition that drives them to produce better products and be more efficient.
Mm.
But they can also partner in some aspects. So it's not one side wins and the other side loses, that kind of lose-win competition. It's more of a partnership.
Yeah, and in that interview, I think there are a couple questions which I thought were rhetorical, but they were very enlightening. You asked regarding competition, a global competition, to what end? And when I read that, I was like, yes, to what end? And also, what does success look like and who will benefit, you know, from this competition, and what collateral damage will such a competition produce? Do you have answers to those questions? Like, what collateral damage?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm most worried about is that if the competition goes too far, we'll start to see the kind of fragmentation that will really damage international institutions and organizations that we've spent a lot of, frankly, time and energy building up in order to manage global issues and conflicts and tensions among countries, but also to manage things like trade, to manage things like climate change and CO2 emissions, to manage global health surveillance, all these things. We've spent a lot of energy building up a system. And now it seems like people are very quick
dismantling
dismantle the system. And I think we're going to miss it when it's gone.
Mm.
And so what I worry about most is this kind of collateral damage to, and not even really realizing that we're doing it, but it will really be very damaging if we have to try to recreate a lot of this.
I think for at least my generation, we kind of take this international system for granted because they were there. You know, when we were growing up, you remind us that it will take much longer. to build something or rebuild something once it's been destroyed. I think more people should hear that. You mentioned last year that you did not believe the U.S. and China are destined for war or on an inevitable collision course, because you believe that this neglects the agency of the actors involved and it doesn't take into account of how the world has changed. Does that belief still stand today? That
Absolutely, you think? So I think all you have to do is look at what we were able to do just by one meeting between President Biden and President Xi in San Francisco, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that wasn't a long meeting. It wasn't a very kind of extended discussion, but just the symbolism and the ability of the two leaders to look each other in the eye and
to shake hands
and make commitments to one another and reaffirm things that they had understood to be the case. So that's one example of human agency. It's always been very important in U.S.-China relations, frankly. That's probably because, you know, we have different systems, different histories, different cultures, and so even more important, the relationship part. Plus, relations very important in Chinese culture. Right?
Yes. Definitely.
Yeah, I think human agency, and I think we're certainly not inevitably headed for conflict because the world has changed. I mean, people today at the conference and in general in the media talk all the time about World War II. Is the current day situation similar to 1914, or is it similar to the 1930s before either World War II? I mean, I really do think we've evolved quite a bit since in the last 100 years. You know, we do have all of these processes and institutions and connectivity. The world has gotten a lot smaller than it was then.
Right.
I mean, people have traveled, people have studied, you know, in different countries.
And we have information
languages. We have information. Yeah, I think it would be, I mean, in a way, the information environment cuts both ways because it's very easy now to manipulate people into believing things that aren't true, and that can have a spiraling effect. But nevertheless, I think we still, with all the changes, and we have principles, we have evolved sort of sense of what right and wrong are, and I think it's a fairly common picture now among a lot of countries. So I think we should be able to avoid this conflict that people talk about being inevitable. I don't think it is.
I'm feeling better just talking to you.
Well, good.
And I want to emphasize the part where you said, you know, this neglects the agency of the actors, because I think we're not just sitting here and watching. We don't have to just sit here and watch. You know, if the parties involved, directly involved in the zone of conflict, if they're too busy doing or thinking outside the box, then maybe the rest of us should be able to do more.
Yeah, and it's very important, as you alluded to earlier, that we get more young people involved. I mean, we have a lot of students here around the conference. I think that's great. And I don't think that our younger generations are inclined to be bystanders. They want to be involved, but sometimes their voice isn't given enough hearing. And so I think it's very important that your generation feel that you can get involved and make a difference. Maybe they're more idealistic in a way, and that's maybe a good thing.
And I mean, the future is, of course, uncertain, and this gives people a strong sense of insecurity. But the other side of the coin is that we have a lot of room for endless possibilities that we can participate to create.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, this is a message.
So many issues to work on.
Already.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
But among all the global uncertainties, we can be certain of one thing, and that is China's commitment to high standard opening up to boost foreign investment. For example, the country is actively seeking to lower the threshold and also reduce the costs and risks associated with foreign investment. And it has renewed the catalog of industries encouraged for foreign investment by adding 239 items, and has implemented over 50 financial opening up measures in recent years. Do you think the U.S. is ready to respond when it comes to trade and foreign investment?
Well, I'm very happy to hear you say how certain you are about China's inevitable continued opening up, because frankly, we've had a lot of questions about that in recent years. And I think probably if we look at those 239 and 50 measures, we would find that not all of them have been fully implemented as was promised.
Okay.
So there's a lot
it takes time.
There's a lot of questions about kind of, you know, the evolution of China's economy and its economic policy making. And I think a lot of people are here this week, actually, for the China Development Forum and for the Boao Forum, both of which will be focused a lot on China's sort of economic policy making environment and development. And people are very interested and curious about that and want China to follow exactly the path that you mentioned and hope that we see, you know, that that will continue. I mean, I think maybe the discussion about China's economic, you know, headwinds is a little bit exaggerated in the West, but that said, I think there's a lot of scope for policymaking improvements and in the direction of opening. I mean, will the U.S. respond in kind? It's a good question. We have gotten into a psychology, I think, in the U.S. that is much more kind of focused on self-reliance after the pandemic, where it was difficult to access a lot of products. So people talk about supply chain resilience now. There's a lot of securitization of, you know, especially in the digital area, because people have become aware of the problems of manipulation, misinformation, disinformation. So there's a lot of concern about connectivity now in the U.S. And we were the original promoters of this, of course. So this is a big change about U.S. attitudes toward all these things. But I think in the end, I mean, the strength of the U.S. is really our openness and our sort of freedom of ideas and in the marketplace. And so I think eventually we will be prepared to respond.
You think maybe the business community will be more willing?
Yeah. The business community certainly is still very unfettered and still, I think, engaged in a lot of areas.
Speaking of technology, so the U.S. Congress has recently passed a bill to ban TikTok, ostensibly due to data privacy concerns. What is your opinion on this proposed ban?
I hate social media.
It can be fun and informative.
I suppose, yeah. I mean, I suppose it has some advantages. I just see people spending a lot of time watching silly videos, so I'm not sure how great it is. But I think this is really a signal of a bigger issue, which is how are we going to deal with the information environment? So, I mean, you probably know that most countries control like news broadcasting, TV, radio, that kind of thing. But we've never had the kind of ban we have on broadcast and TV over the internet, because when we came up with the internet, it was supposed to be this free and open space where everyone would become democratized. And now we find out that it's actually got some negative aspects. And so the U.S. has been pretty slow, I would say, to regulate the internet, because we're trying to keep the space open to see where it's going to go. And I think this TikTok ban, you know, I don't like the idea of banning just one company through a law. I think that's not the right way to do it. The law should articulate some kind of a principle, right? So I don't think it's a perfect bill, and I don't know if it will pass. I think it will run into a lot of trouble, actually. But I think the sentiment is understandable, probably, that, you know, you want to be careful about what kit, especially since it's used by young people.
Younger people.
It's really important to sort of figure out what the best way is to regulate.
It takes some self-discipline.
Yeah.
But I have actually learned a lot from watching the videos, because I seek for information instead of entertainment. And for one thing, I think it's a good place where you can see people's actual daily lives. And for people, let's say American people, they'll actually have an avenue to see just regular people, how they live their lives here in China or in other countries. So that's where, you know, at least that's one positive thing.
Yeah, there are definitely positive aspects. I grant you that. I just think that you might be more rare exception of a disciplined person looking at this TikTok videos than maybe some other people. But yeah, I mean, I think the key to social media is to use it in moderation.
And with a purpose.
And with a purpose and limited.
With some guidance.
With some skeptical attitude maybe on some of the information.
That's important. And also 2024 is a presidential election year in the U.S. In your opinion, how would a continuation of the Biden administration or a new Trump administration change the direction of American foreign policy towards China?
It's a good question. I don't know if anyone really has the answer. It's very early in our election cycle, so it's very hard to tell you know, what the probabilities are of these things happening. But I think the difference will be in the mind of American voters kind of voting for some kind of continuity and stability in the case of the Biden administration. You know, people have concerns about his age and, you know, how he'll weather, you know, the coming years. But I think it's been pretty clear that it's a normal American administration, continuation of kind of American governing principles, etc. You know, if Trump comes back in, then it'll be kind of a referendum on sort of a growing nationalism slash isolationism in the U.S. Now, how that affects American foreign policy, it's going to be also very unclear, but it's the tendency of the U.S. to not be very interested in international institutions, trade. You know, we know that President Trump had a big aversion to trade deficits.
Right.
That came up in the relationship with China. So I think that would probably reemerge.
Even
more. We still have a big trade deficit with China. It hasn't really gone down. In fact, I think it's expanded since Trump was in office. So
it didn't work?
It didn't work, right? It didn't work. And then there's lots of reasons for that. But it doesn't mean he's not convinced that it could work.
Mm.
And I think one of the things that is certainly happening in the United States is how should the United States adjust to a changing world? And I think there's still not really much even realization of the U.S. that needs to be a discussion that we need to have, never mind have we had the discussion and sort of a conversation in society about that.
So for the population to understand how the world has been changing and has changed.
Yes. And it's very hard. Change is very hard, you know.
Especially when you've been at the top.
Yeah. So I think people are worried about sort of power shifting and relative loss of power and influence in the global system. But what's the reaction to that? What's the right reaction to that? What's the best way to handle that, et cetera, is still an unsettled issue.
But I feel the American people are so consumed with America's involvement in both the Ukraine war and the conflict in the Middle East and possible conflict in Asian Pacific area. Do they have the space even to think about themselves adapting to change to the international order?
Yeah, that's a good question. It is a challenge. There's always some, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up because, I mean, I have a lot of friends in other countries who raise this question about the U.S. being involved in everything and questioning whether that should be the case. But then when something happens somewhere in the world, it's funny how everyone turns to what are the Americans going to do about this? You know, any fire alarm that rings, everyone comes racing to Washington to say, what are you going to do? So we do get sort of called in on every single crisis. And that is a reflex in the international system, too, that maybe we've brought upon ourselves, possibly you could say, but there's no real clear solution. You know, people have to step up and take responsibility, and it's not easy.
It's not easy.
Let's just say.
But, you know, I have to say the conversation with you is already the most hopeful that I've heard in a while. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for your time.
You should be hopeful. You have a lot of bright and prosperous years ahead. So I'm sure you all will contribute.
And if there's one thing I remember from this interview is the agency of the people, that we do have the ability and the space to create the reality that we want. We can't just be bystanders. We're just watching things in horror. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. Yes. Thank you.
That was my conversation with Ms. Susan Thornton, retired U.S. diplomat and senior fellow at the Yale Law School, Paul Tsai China Center. Please stay tuned for more informative interviews in this series. Thank you.